commit adultery. But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, gouge it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. It has been said, anyone who divorces his wife must give her a certificate of divorce. But I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife, except for marital unfaithfulness, causes her to become an adulteress. And anyone who marries a divorced woman commits adultery.
Mute it. Oh, good. There we are. Lust, adultery, and divorce. Yeah, thanks for asking. And how was your weekend? On the surface, this is a topic that is about sex and marital relationships, but underneath and at its depth, it's a topic about keeping your word. It's a topic about honesty. How far will you go to be true to your word? How far will I go to remain honest and faithful and to commit to the things that I have said I will do? That's what the topic is about. Now, the first thing that we need to say is that this is not appearing on that screen. This is a painful subject. This is something that lust and adultery is something that probably most people in the Christian church and in society generally have struggled with. I understand that about one person in 20 is never really troubled by thoughts of sexual lust. How marvelous must that be? But for the rest of us, it's a topic that really troubles us. Oh, thanks, Christine. And the failure of adultery and of divorce is something that affects so many people in society, including many of us, thank you, that we know that the pain is ever present, and the pain is amidst us for many. It's a hard thing to hear. These words that we read this morning are difficult to listen to, and it's for sure a hard thing to preach on or to come to on a Sunday morning. In fact, I see half the church hasn't come. I wonder if that's why. No, don't start thinking about the people who aren't here. That's not fair. It's difficult. I came up to bed late one night this week, and Jane said, yeah, how's it going? And I said, oh, adultery is such hard work. I think she understood what I was talking about. Because it's about betrayal. It's about the emotional pain that is caused by betrayal. It's about the damage that couples can inflict on themselves, on their children, on their friends, on their communities. It's about us. It's human. So how common is it? There's a little graph. That's from the Office of National Statistics. Marriages at the top, divorces at the bottom. First thing you'll notice, rather interestingly, is the divorce rate is starting to go down very slightly. There's all sorts of reasons for that, but still the problem is huge. Still, a third of all marriages will fail by the time they reach their 15th anniversary. The 11th year is the dangerous one, apparently, not the 7th anymore. And the rate of divorce among over 50s is going up quite extraordinarily. Young people, it appears to be going down more sharply than before. So that's interesting. But adultery and divorce have therefore directly affected people in this room. There's no way we can get away from that. We're sure that that's going to be the case, either in your families or in extended relationships. And for every story we know, and everyone we know who has suffered this way, there will be secret pains and there will be hidden failures, which we have to think about all the time. And every time there is a divorce, every time there is an act of adultery, every time there is unfaithfulness, it's a car crash. And there are people who need emergency care and long-term healing and great forgiveness. It's not a time for judgment. It's not a moment when we say, you should be punished over and over again for this. So the terms in which we're addressing this today are those of, if it is this common, and if it causes so much pain in our society, and if Jesus addresses it directly, we can't do anything but listen to what he has to say. We have to go to the healer when there is so much pain. But we're going to a healer, not a judge. The first thing then we need to say for those especially who might be listening to this online is this is part of a series. So we know that this is now part of a series. I think we're four parts into an eight-part series on Matthew chapter 5, which is the beginning of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. So it comes in a context of things that we've said before. And part of that context is Jesus saying that he has not come to abolish the old law of Moses, but to fulfill the law, to complete the law. If you like, he's like a garage mechanic lifting up the bonnet of the car. Ryan, that's the hood of the car. He's lifting it up and saying, okay, the car broke down, but here's why. Here's the explanation underneath the bonnet, the hood, of what's been going on. And last week, we learned that he took the first of the laws that he wanted to talk about, and he said, the law said, you shall not commit murder. And then he opens up the bonnet, and he says, now, inside, here's what it means. It's about anger. It's about that attitude of your heart that will inflict pain and damage upon someone else if you possibly could. And if you're angry with a brother or sister, you've committed murder in your heart. Don't let your heart get into that state. Well, so much for death. Now let's talk about sex, because these are great subjects. And so we're on to the seventh commandment of Moses' law when God said, you will not commit adultery. And the Jewish teachers of the law at the time interpreted that to say, quite simply, if you're in a marriage relationship and you're caught having sex outside of marriage, you have committed adultery. And if you aren't caught, you're fine. You're free. Good. Well done, you. And Jesus lifts up the bonnet and he says, well, let's just look at that a bit. Let's just expose that just a little bit more. To fulfill this law, he says, I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully, now this was a patriarchal society, so every time I see looks at a woman, I want you to think, looks at a woman or looks at a man, okay? Because we now have lovely equality where we can all sin together in this regard. Anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. In saying this, he's exposing the deep root of what it is that leads us to adultery, but he's also giving us the key to success for victorious lives and relationships in this area. We are accused commonly in the non-Christian world of being anti-sex. The church is accused quite commonly of being negative and repressive and hostile to the whole area of sex. And as many of us know in this room, that is not true. Sex is a wonderful thing in its right environment. And Jesus is not here being negative about sex. He is being positive about faithfulness, about love, about relationship, and about trust. He's being positive about us giving our word to one another in public, in front of the community, and keeping that word no matter what happens and whatever temptation comes to us. If we're serious about wanting to get the best out of this gift of sex and the gift of marriage, Jesus is saying, I want to give you the key that shows you why these things fail and why they go wrong and what you can do about it. It's not just about, did you do something wrong and did you get caught? It's about how can you get your heart to be in line with the will of God so that when you stand and you make a promise to someone, that promise is going to stick and is going to be fulfilled. So when you look at a woman or a man lustfully, you've already committed adultery in your heart. You've already declared the intention. Maybe you wanted to take that person for yourself, but you just didn't get the opportunity. Maybe, like most of us, you're probably just too cowardly to follow through on the lustful desire. But put yourself in a different situation, give yourself a bit of power, give yourself unlimited amounts of money, make yourself famous, and you too could be Donald Trump. Bragging about grabbing women by their private parts, and who knows, maybe if you get enough power, just going through with it, if the opportunity was there. A lot of things that don't go wrong in society and sometimes in church is simply because we don't have the opportunity to fulfill the things that are going on in our hearts. And Jesus is saying, get the heart sorted out, and then it doesn't matter what opportunity comes up or how powerful you become or how rich and successful you are, you will not take advantage of other people in this area because you've changed. What you really are, who you really are, is who you are in the privacy of your mind. And if I could have my thoughts projected up on that screen every day and every moment for people coming by to see, would they look like God's thoughts or would they look like something that you just would want to run away from? Now, let's be honest, there are some really attractive, beautiful people in this room. And some of the girls aren't bad, are they? It's not about whether you find people attractive. That's not the sin. That's not even the temptation. Recognizing God's creativity in making people handsome or attractive is not the issue. And recognizing that and acknowledging that is fine. It's not that we want a society where everyone is covered up. But religion would have everybody covered up because we don't trust people's hearts not to respond to the beauty and the delight of the people around us in an appropriate way. Religion just says we've got to cover it all up and hide it all away because we don't trust your heart. And Jesus says, get your heart sorted out. And then you can acknowledge God's grace and creativity in establishing the beauty of the people around you. When Jesus says, whoever looks at a woman lustfully, the verb in Greek is present continuous, looks and keeps on looking, gazes. It's not just a look and move on, acknowledge, and now let's live our lives. It's that deep intent. It's the difference between acknowledging beauty and twisting it for your own gratification. I can acknowledge that someone is beautiful without wanting to take her to bed in my mind. That's what Jesus is saying. Or as Martin Luther put it 500 years ago, you can't stop a bird from flying over your head, and he's talking about lustful thoughts, but you can stop that bird from building a nest in your hair. Delightful. Singles. Bet you thought you were going to get an easy ride today. No one's exempt, apart from that odd 1 in 20 who is, from the possibility of lust. And single people have the most extraordinary opportunity to teach the church and society about what faithfulness, perseverance, and purity actually means. Single people have a harder challenge in our society than almost any of the rest of us, and any time that I can remember, because at the moment, the whole culture is leaning towards sex is normal, sex is free, sex has no repercussions, you should have as many relationships as possible, in direct opposition to what the Bible teaches us about sex being the seal on a relationship that will last forever. And if you, as a single person, look lustfully, you have committed adultery, perhaps against a partner you haven't even met yet. Even if you're going to stay single, even if singleness is your call, the lustful look will undermine the rest of your life. It will be part of a trend towards lust and adulterous behavior. But refusing to take part in what the world says is normal for relationships is an investment, first of all, in your own relationships, in the purity and the sanctity of your relationships. It's an investment in the kingdom of God because God says this stuff is important, and it's an investment in a possible future relationship that you'll have with another person. So being single is not the time to play the field. That's what one of my relatives, I won't say who, one of my relatives used to say to me when I was a young single man, oh, this is your opportunity to play the field and test everyone out and see who's right for you. Nah, doesn't work that way. Because what it does is it creates habits that you would take with you into your married relationship. It creates that habit of looking at people as opportunities rather than looking at people as human beings made in the image of God with whom you can have a holy, pure, and upbuilding relationship. It's a time to learn positive habits, to flee immorality, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 6, to run from it, not just to stand there and pretend you can withstand it, but to actually run away from it. And to, as it says in 1 Thessalonians 4, avoid sexual immorality and passionate lust. And it adds, in case you're at all got any questions about that, do not in this matter wrong a brother or sister. So to actually inflict your lusts upon someone else who might be weaker or persuadable is to wrong a brother or sister. Now, I wonder if anyone saw this article last week. A bunch of researchers, four, have done some brain research where they've mapped out what happens in people's brains when they tell little lies, little self-serving lies. This was all the news about last Tuesday. And they've demonstrated using functional magnetic resonance imaging, that the little neural pathway that is created when you tell a small lie is then reinforced as soon as you tell a slightly bigger lie. In other words, it makes it more possible for the first lie to become a bit of a bigger lie and then a bit of a bigger lie. And eventually they found in the laboratory, people were telling absolute whoppers that when they first came in, they would not have been able to tell, but because they had practiced by doing a little bit of lying, they developed the art of lying very quickly in a laboratory situation. We think that's probably common to mankind. If you read the book of Proverbs, it talks about this kind of thing all the time. That when you practice small sins in the mind, you make it easier for them to become bigger sins in the mind. So a few pages of, 50 Shades of Grey, or a little flick through the pornographic pages on the internet will make it more likely that you will do that again another time. And you do it and you lie about it, or you don't tell people about it, and you'll do it again, and each time you will be able to do more, read more. I mean, heaven help you, reading 50 Shades of Grey, the grammar is appalling. But the stuff that you read there makes it more likely that your mind will dwell upon the same subjects again, and these things grow. They increase. Do you think that you're strong enough to withstand? Are you stronger than Samson? Are you wiser than Solomon? Or are you holier than David? You read their stories, and what was the thing that brought them down in each case? Lust, adultery, the inability to master what was in their minds and their hearts in their physical relationships. And so 1 Corinthians 10, 12 and 13 says, if you think you're standing firm, be careful. It's easy to point the finger at other people who have visibly fallen, and there's nothing more visible than divorce and adultery when it's exposed. Be careful that you don't fall. No temptation has overtaken you except what is common to everyone, to mankind. And God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear, but when you are tempted, He will provide a way out so you can endure it. We learned a couple of weeks ago that the law's purpose, as Jesus defines it, is to show us our temptation and our sin, to expose it and to lead us to repentance so that He can set us free to obey Him. Jesus' answer, provide a way out, is be ruthless. If your eye offends you, gouge it out. If your hand is leading you into sin, cut it off and throw away, because it's better to be without those things than to go to hell. Now then, I've been told, I've actually asked a blind person this question in a church, blind people can lust. Cutting out an eye actually doesn't stop you lusting. And astonishingly, one-armed people can be adulterers. And there's one of the most famous. So cutting off your hand and gouging out your eye is not what Jesus is getting at. He's using exaggerated language. What he's saying is, whatever it is that leads you down this path, whatever you've started to do that creates that channel in your brain that is leading you to lust and will lead you to adultery and possibly to divorce, stop it. That's all he's saying. Whatever it takes, don't do it. Whatever the book is that you read that gives you these thoughts, stop reading it. Whatever the pictures are that you look at on the internet that gives you those thoughts, stop looking at them. Be ruthless. Cut it off as though it was a part of your body. If you go on the internet and you look at the Daily Mail page and it is the right hand, oh how interesting, column, that leads you astray because it is full of stories of adultery and people running around naked and the sizes of people's bodies. If that's what leads you astray, cut it off. There will be films that you will not be able to watch anymore, possibly. TV programs you should not watch. Websites you should not go to. Cut them off. And don't let other people's, other Christians' standard of behavior be your guide for behavior, because this is about, according to Jesus, you, your heart, your mind. When anyone looks at another person lustfully, then they've committed adultery. And it might be different for you than for others. And sometimes the things other people can do, you can no longer do. And the truth is, your eternal life, according to Jesus, may depend on it. It is better to lose that thing than to be thrown into hell enjoying that thing. And you hear non-Christians all the time, oh, Christianity looks so boring. I want to go to hell where it's a constant party and constant sex. And you think, oh, you have no idea. Now, this thing about divorce then becomes a subset of the question about adultery. It's actually, it follows on, hello? It follows on from his discussion on adultery. And this was the religious debate of the day. When you read the Jewish literature from the time, all the top Jewish leaders were talking about Moses' law for what do you do if you want to divorce a woman? And you find in Matthew 19, this bunch of Pharisees comes to Jesus and says the question that they were all asking each other. Is it lawful, as Moses said, for a man to divorce his wife for any and every reason? And Jesus said, no. And the famous teachers were divided, and Jesus says this, haven't you read that at the beginning the Creator made them male and female? Don't ever let anyone tell you that Jesus had nothing to say about homosexuality. He made them male and female and said, for this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no one separate. And the Pharisees said, hey, but wait a minute. Moses gave us an out. He said that if we divorce our wife, we can just write a certificate and send her off with the certificate. And Jesus says in Matthew 19, nah, he did this not to permit you, but because you're so stubborn and paternalistic a culture that he couldn't stop you divorcing your wives. So he said, write the certificate so that at least when she goes, she can prove it's your fault, basically, that she's got the certificate that says the man sent her away. Send her away honorably. Anyone who divorces his wife, he says there, except for sexual immorality, and marries another woman, commits adultery, irrespective of what it says on the certificate. Now, here's a fun thing. On the internet, you can go to this website, and for £30, they'll name a star for you. And they'll send you a certificate, and it tells you what the where the star is. It gives you the proper reading so you can find your star. And if you're a couple, for £100, you can buy a binary star. How lovely is that? That's wonderful. And they send you the certificate, and the certificate tells you that the star that you've told them, they have named, and here's the name, and here's the certificate that proves it's got that name. Fantastic. There's a star named after you, or after your loved one. The problem is, nobody recognizes this stuff. The International Astronomical Union, which has the duty of naming stars, doesn't pay any attention to this company, and nobody, apart from you with your certificate, will be able to say that star is named after me, because nobody has named that star. They've just done it on a computer somewhere like that. The certificate is worthless. Why is it worthless? It's worthless because it does not follow the rules of what a star naming process is. It doesn't follow the IAU's star naming process. So you've got a certificate, but it is not true. It's not a valid certificate. And that's what Jesus is saying about this certificate of divorce that Moses permitted the men to write. It can say what you want it to say. You can say, oh, I'm divorcing you because you are boring. I'm divorcing you because you don't do the washing up. I'm divorcing you because my wife doesn't understand me. I'm divorcing you for whatever reason. You can write the certificate, but in God's sight, it is valueless. It's nothing. It doesn't dissolve the marriage in the sight of God unless there is marital unfaithfulness. And so he suddenly pulls the rug out from underneath these Jewish men and all their possibilities for why they've got divorced. Doesn't mean that God agrees with you just because you've written the certificate. So Luke sums up what Jesus teaches in one phrase. So takes the bit that he has in Matthew 19 and the bit that he has in Matthew 5 and puts it into one verse. Anyone who divorces his wife, spouse, and marries another woman or man commits adultery, and the one who marries a divorced person commits adultery. That's fairly blunt. What makes a divorce real then is sexual immorality, effectively. One partner is unfaithful, that breaks the marriage in God's sight because it's about a promise, the betrayal of a promise. Under those circumstances, the piece of paper becomes real. 1 Corinthians 7 opens up another possibility when a believer's unbelieving spouse walks away from the marriage, leaving the believer. That's a possibility. And since Puritan times, I was interested to find, churches have taught that if one party in the marriage is physically or emotionally violent and abusive to the other party in the marriage, that is treated as putting distance, that the word for leaving, creating distance between. That could be a valid reason for divorce. There is no excuse in Christianity for a spouse physically or emotionally abusing the other spouse. That is a situation you have to escape from, you have to get out of. But that's another topic. So let's make it simple. That's Ephesians 5, 25 to 33. That's the picture of what a Christian marriage should look like. And if one party in the marriage is physically abusing the other party in the marriage, it doesn't really look like love your wives as your own bodies. You must love your wife as you love yourself. You can pretend to be a believer, but if you're abusing your spouse, there is a different spirit at work. And that would be like an unbeliever walking away from, leaving the marriage. So to conclude, God made marriage precious. There we go. Marriage is good. It's intended to last as long as we live. It's a declaration of trust and hope and faith for as long as we live. It's not a temporary contract, which our society is now trying to talk about. They're talking about introducing time-limited marriages, where you can try it for 20 years, and if you really get on okay, you can then extend and have another contract afterwards. That's seriously being discussed. That's not God's plan for it. It's not like getting a TV, and if you look at your next-door neighbor's TV and think they've got a bigger TV than your TV, you want their TV. That's not the way marriage works. It's not something you trade in. On the other hand, adultery is bad. It is a breaking of a relationship. And you find all through the Old Testament, God says it is like idolatry with him. So if the church becomes idolatrous and leaves God behind, that's the same picture of the Christian marriage which has gone into adultery. God hates divorce, he says, because of that picture it presents of a broken relationship, a broken covenant of faith thrown back in the face of the other person. Therefore, lust is a bad thing because it is adultery in the heart, because it is when you open the engine cover and you look inside and you find all that bad stuff going on, you know it's leading towards a breakdown, adultery in the flesh. Having said that, let us remember that Jesus starts the Sermon on the Mount with, blessed are the poor in spirit. And he ends chapter 5 with, be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. There it is, Matthew 5:48. Perfection is our goal. Perfection is the journey we've started on, the adventure we're going into. Perfection is what is in God's heart. And when Jesus is saying these things, he's saying the law is all pointing us to perfection. He is perfectly faithful. When we let God down, he sticks by us. When we make mistakes and break relationships, he stays with us. He is courting us. He is calling us. He is drawing us back, always drawing us back to relationship with him, to put right the things that have gone wrong and to continue to turn us into better people. And so faced with this call to perfection, we absolutely need the first phrase that he uses in the Sermon on the Mount, "Blessed are the poor in spirit," because we know we're not there yet. Some of us are very publicly and visibly demonstrated to be not there yet, and some of us deep in our hearts, we know that we've broken the law in some places, and many of us have broken the law in this area of lust and the potential for adultery. Our thoughts, projected up there and compared to perfection, should probably make us squirm. We know we need forgiveness. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Remember that God loved you before you ever knew him. Before you even realized you had committed sins, God loved you and died for you and poured out his blood on the cross for you to draw you back into a new way of having relationships. And blessed means God intends to bless you. Knowing that you are poor in spirit, he wants to transform me and you. He wants to change us day by day into the image of Jesus, who, faced with every temptation to lust, did not succumb to the sin. And in that sense also, he fulfilled the law. He completed it. He accomplished it. And by living in Jesus, we can have that accomplishment as well. He saved the life of the woman caught in adultery and demonstrated to the religious people that they had no right to throw stones because the same sins were in their hearts. But then he said, "Go and sin no more. If your eye offends you, gouge it out. If your hand leads you to sin, cut it off." In the preface to the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus did not say, "Blessed are the righteous." He said, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness." That's the heart that would cut off the hand if the hand was leading us to sin, that would abandon every possible temptation that might lead us wrong. If we long for a clean heart, if we're crying out for pure relationships, if we're putting our energy into building secure marriages and creating an environment where marriages are safe and secure, if we will do anything we can to stay faithful to God, if we will keep our promises in a culture which no longer values the keeping of promises or the telling of truth in public life, if we will show that we care about what God says and what he tells us to do, he promises to bless us. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness. And as I said at the beginning, in my mind, the whole question about adultery and divorce is about oaths and keeping your promises, and will you keep your promise in the most difficult situations, despite what's going on in your own heart, in order to stay faithful? And we're going to hear more about that next week, which is a continuation of this same theme. Thank you.